KZSU-FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an associate professor at Elon University School of Law, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, and in the 2014-15 academic year, a visiting research collaborator at Princeton's Center for Information Technology Policy. Today, I'm excited to have on one repeat guest and one new guest, but they are two of four co-editors of a fascinating book that's just been published by Cambridge University Press entitled Privacy, Big Data, and the Public Good. We're going to be chatting today with Julia Lane and Victoria Stodden. Not joining us today are their co-editors Stefan Bender and Helen Nissenbaum, Helen who's also previously been on Hearsay Culture. But for those of you that listen to the show regularly and certainly that pay attention to issues that have become a gigantic question and problem and opportunity in technology, it is this amorphous idea and concept known as big data. And what big data is a question that is yet to be fully answered, except to say extremely large data sets. But the questions that Julia and Victoria are answering through terrific contributing chapters from other people who have been on Hearsay Culture in the past, including Catherine Sandberg and Paul Ohm. And others whose work many people will be familiar with, including people like John Wilbanks and Dan Greenwood and Carl Landwehr and others, are asking is how you integrate the opportunities of big data with the various questions that we have around privacy, and then how ultimately governments, as a subtitle suggests, frameworks for engagement, can utilize big data in ways that achieve all of these benefits without running into the many drawbacks that might exist. And so in the book, again, Victoria and Julia are editors, and there are three parts to the book. Part one is entitled Conceptual, part two is Practical, and then part three, because Victoria is involved undoubtedly, I'm kidding to some degree on that, but I'm sure that it's a big part of it, there's a statistical focus as well. And of course, when we're talking about data, all kidding aside, statistics plays an enormous role for reasons that are obvious to most people, but certainly involve the use of numbers and algorithms and information and trying to make sense of all of it. We're going to be focusing today primarily on parts one and two of the book, the conceptual and practical framework, and your classic theory and policy type analysis, by asking a number of questions. I'll really be asking Victoria and Julia a number of questions dealing with this issue of what is the public good and the public's interest in big data, and how might we defend both the public's interest in the use of that data and their rights to privacy, and of course, you know, conversely, the government's ability to use that data quite well in ways that ultimately will be beneficial for all. These are questions that we are still really beginning, I think, to get our heads around, and so I was very excited when I came across this book, being familiar with Victoria's work, having come across Julia's work, and then, as I mentioned, having had Helen on the show previously, as well as being generally familiar with Stefan's work. Four terrific people have brought together more terrific people to discuss this issue. It's kind of a no-brainer for Hearsay Culture, and so here we are. Before we begin our discussion, by way of brief background, Julia Lane is an Institute Fellow at the American Institutes for Research. She's a professor of economics, a Beta University of Strasbourg affiliate, as well as having been involved in a number of these issues, both in the EU as well as in Australia, where she is a professor at the Melbourne Institute of Applied Economics and Social Research at the University of Melbourne. She was formerly director of the National Science Foundation's Science of Science and Innovation Policy Program. And she's been a senior research fellow at the U.S. Census Bureau, which I've heard has a lot of data and a lot of statistics involved. She's a prolific author, and she's testified on these issues in front of both the U.S. Congress and the European Parliament. And she is joining us via Skype from Queensland. And Victoria Stodden, by way of, again, brief background, is an assistant professor of statistics at Columbia University. She is, I guess this is a degree on home turf, because she got her PhD in statistics and her law degree at Stanford. So she is definitely getting the home field advantage here, as it were. Her research centers on this issue involving not just big data, but really fascinating stuff that we've previously discussed on the show, which is reproducibility in computational science, the need to be able to not only see and understand what comes out of research, but to be able to verify and repeat it, is something which, as we had previously discussed, has kind of received wisdom within the scientific community, but which perhaps has eroded a bit over time and needs to be reintroduced in ways. In that way, she's a developer of the award-winning Reproducible Research Standard, which is an open licensing set of recommendations, and therefore she has co-founded RunMyCode.org, which is really interesting stuff. Victoria is joining us from her office at Columbia via Skype. We are recording this show on July 10th, 2014, and Victoria has both the blessing and the curse of having to teach a summer course, and so therefore she's on a tight schedule. So my lengthy introduction will end now, and I will simply say thank you, Julia. Thank you, Victoria, for joining me today on Hearsay Culture.
Well, it's a real pleasure to be here.
So let me start off, and Julia, I'll start off with you, since you're the relative newbie, at least to Hearsay Culture. Tell us a bit more about your background and why and how you came to focus on privacy and big data before we define those terms.
So my background is that I'm an economist by training, and I got very interested in building large-scale data sets in the late 90s at the United States Census Bureau, using a variety of different administrative data. And it became very clear that as you're building information on human beings, that it's very important to get the privacy and confidentiality issues right. So in 2001, we produced a book on statistical disclosure limitation for federal statistical agencies, and worked through what a lot of the privacy and confidentiality issues were in those days. The difference now is, of course, 14 years ago, the way in which data were collected was they were typically purposefully collected and under some statutory authorization. So the authorization for the Census Bureau, there are two main sources of data. One is data collected under Title 13 of the U.S. Code, and then there are administrative data that are collected from the Internal Revenue Service, and that's covered by Title 26 of the U.S. Code. As after that book was published, which actually got quite a lot of attention because it really helped set the stage for the legal and statistical environment under which data should be collected for administrative records, the world kind of evolved. So in the 2000s, what I was doing was working at the National Science Foundation and looking at all the data that the computer scientists were able to generate. It was called cyber infrastructure, and it still is called cyber infrastructure. And so now the data are no longer being purposefully collected, and there's no clear data custodian, and there's no clear statutory authorization. So my concern was, what is the legal framework for which the data on those human beings, which are incredibly rich and incredibly valuable, can be collected? And what is the statistical validity that accrues to those data? And then the last thing is, because you've got a void of understanding of why and how the data can be collected ethically and legally, my concern was that the private sector would be taking the data to the bank, as it were, and the public sector, the research sector, would be disenfranchised because we didn't know how to deal with it, so the answer would be no. So that's kind of my background. as an economist trying to deal with very practical issues, how to get high quality scientific research done in a appropriate privacy and confidentiality framework.
Victoria?
So my PhD is in statistics, and as you mentioned, and Julia actually spearheaded this book, and so she asked me to be involved, so that's directly how I got involved. But my research topic is around issues in reproducibility of computational science. So much of the work statisticians would do now and researchers would do is computer-based in terms of inference from data, and this opens a host of issues around the ability to verify data or verify the code that produced results in a publication and so on. And one of the issues when you're trying to do this and access data is the privacy and confidentiality issue. So it opens this question about, well, how do we work with issues of privacy and issues of confidentiality that may adhere to data that's used in research, and how do we ensure that we're still having very high quality reproducible research and yet balance it with these privacy concerns. So that was how I became interested in the topic. And so I think what Julia is outlining, that having all these types of data that are now not, you know, sort of structured and gathered in a very deliberative way for certain purposes, probably including research purposes and so on, the way that a lot of research data has been in the past, we sort of ran this risk, if we didn't take a look at these issues around privacy and around confidentiality, that this would simply be sort of locked away as inaccessible. And I think one of the things that we wanted to show in the book is that it's not necessarily the case. There are lots of questions around disclosure of data with privacy issues around it, but really, what is the actual legal framework that controls this and controls access and how you use it or gather the data, and how can we do things like ensure quality and reliability of the inferences that come from this data? So we really wanted to sort of take a good hard look at this issue, since many of them are new and things have changed a lot, as Julia mentioned, since her first book in 2001.
So we are, I should point out that we are recording this show now on July 13th. You, for those of you who have been listening closely, you might have heard that the introduction is a few days earlier because of a variety of technical issues that make for really bad radio, both discussing them and recording through them. We are now recording on Sunday, July 13th. So I'm going to do something very original here, Julia and Victoria. I'm going to ask you to define the three words in the title, and I'm going to do them in a very specific and well thought out way. I'm going to ask you about these words and phrases alphabetically. So it's a radical way to approach it, but I'm going to do that. So why don't we start here? And Victoria, I guess I'll ask you this first question before I turn to Julia with regard to the word privacy. You know, these are, of course, privacy, big data, public good, these are not new terms, but they are amorphous terms. And we've discussed all three of these ideas, privacy in particular, heavily on this show. So Victoria, why don't you give us, for purposes of this book and certainly based, you know, upon your research, how do you define big data? What is it?
Oh, that's a great question. So what we meant by the term was this new type of data that's being collected and used in research that's not a result of a research initiative. So traditionally you would have a researcher with a question who would then either procure the data, for example, carrying out a survey or collecting the data to start to answer that question, or they would perhaps go to the Census Bureau or other sort of standard government-based sources of data in order to carry out their research. And so now, with so much digitization, data is not collected in, I guess, what you would say sort of such a deliberative way for to support research. We have an enormous amount of data that wasn't collected for research and yet could answer so many interesting research questions. So that was our sort of take on big data. And we actually had a discussion as authors whether we should use the term, because it's so widely used in the press and it sort of all carries its own freighted meanings already. And we went with it because we thought that was that really did capture what was new about the situation with data, that prompted us to really think through these questions and pull these chapters together into the book. So it's that the data landscape itself has changed in this way, rather than laws have changed or other things have changed. It really was the nature of the data itself that researchers are using. And part of our sponsorship for the book came from NYU, and one of the things that they were interested in, just in general, is data in an urban setting. And so part of big data, or at least that falls under the rubric that I just outlined, is how much data is collected on us in cities through things like sensors or, you know, other pieces of data collection equipment that just pull in all these different types of data. So we have sort of like a city's focus a little bit in parts of the book, and also we are focusing, as in addition to traditional sources of data, on all the different types of data that are collected and that we have to confront just as citizens now that we didn't have to, say, in 2001.
So, Julia, let me follow up with you, and probably the most amorphous term or word of the big three that you've listed here is privacy. So how do you define that concept in the book?
Well, I'd actually like to punt that one to Victoria to give a much more technical version than I can. She's got the much more of the legal background. I can give you a layman's version, but I'd much rather that she give it and then I jump in, if that's okay with you.
Fair enough, Victoria.
Yeah, that's fine. So actually, the way we're using the term privacy in the title, I didn't understand it to be necessarily sort of a legal definition. It's sort of the same way that we're using the phrase big data. We're kind of working on these terms that have sort of floated into like our public consciousness or what have you, and trying to sort out issues. Like if you mention to someone, this was our impression, you talk about kind of this phrase big data, I think the first thing that many people think about is, oh, well, if people are collecting data on me, then where does that leave me? And things may be exposed that I don't realize, and so on. And especially interactions with, say, social networks or whatever it is. And so what we wanted to do was think about this from a researcher's perspective, and then think about, well, what is that interaction? And so, just sort of starting to go into the weeds of the book a little bit, one of the first things we do in the book is try to answer this legal question. So what can you do legally in terms of data collection if you're just going to go and collect data on people, and then what can you how can you actually legally use this data? So to me, those are the first questions that jump into your mind if you think about big data and its intersection with privacy and research. And so that's the first thing we try and do in the book, is we have a few chapters that just try and say, well, what are the sort of controlling laws that that allow people to collect the data? Like, how did we get to this state where we've got people who are worried about privacy and thinking about big data or data that's being collected on them? Like, how is this something that is a society now that we're worried about? And that's my impression, that this is a real issue that people in society are trying to address, as well as researchers trying to address it. So we start to kind of wrap our minds around, well, what's actually out there that controls? And of course, the first thing that our authors run into is that the legal definitions and controls on data don't seem to match where we are in 2014, and they identify some of these gaps and so on, and where ethics start to stand in and informed consent starts to come up, and how we can actually start to make decisions that protect people and yet allow us to exploit the all the information and inference that we could actually learn from the data itself, rather than, you know, simply locking everything down.
Julia, do you want anything to that?
Yeah, so the reason I wanted to have Victoria go first on that one was that, and she did a great job of summarizing what the issues are. In this particular case, I think we weren't, I'll be honest and say, we weren't very clear on what the term privacy meant from a legal standpoint. And the first five chapters, you will see that Kathy Strandberg and Helen Nissenbaum and others are really struggling with trying to define what is meant by privacy in the current environment with this current way of collecting data. And I think we throw around the term privacy a great deal, and we really don't have a strong technical definition. So part of the contribution of the book is to get at what exactly does it mean from an operational point of view. The second part of, so I'm giving you an economist answer, right? Mm-hmm. Because you're wanting to have one answer, and I'm going to give you two.
Right? That's fine. So, I'm a lawyer, so don't worry about that.
Well, okay, good. I think part of what Helen Nissenbaum does so nicely is she talks a great deal about contextual privacy, which I think is very important, which is, you know, I might put stuff up on the web, but I put it up expecting it to be done, used in one context, and all of a sudden it's being used in another context. Let me get specific about that. I'm interested in looking at the science of science policy, and people put their CVs up on the web with all their publications and their employment and their education history. So does that mean that I can then go out and pull those data and take a look at them? Have they, in some sense, agreed by putting it up on the web that is accessible? In a similar context, as Victoria mentioned, the prime impetus for the book is the Center for Urban Science and Progress at New York University, which is this path-breaking effort by Bloomberg to improve the management of a city. So if I put my light on in a window that people can see, is it okay for that to be used? Is my seeing that you have turned your light on, is that violating privacy? If I walk down the street and you take a picture of me, or if I swipe my card in the subway system, or if I use a taxi, or if I use the sewage system, if I take the data that is generated by those activities, those digital footprints, have I violated in any way what we think of as your privacy? And let me be clear on this. This is fundamentally different from the types of data collection that social scientists and economists are used to using, which, as Victoria said, we go out and we ask a survey, so we purposefully collect the data. This is data that is found, not made. So in what sense, if the data are already there and the data have been generated and they're sitting out there, in what sense is it a violation or any kind of infringement of privacy to make use of data that already exist that are lying about and getting reused? So that's what we're struggling with in the book. Exactly what do we mean by privacy in that context?
We're chatting.
So you're not going to get an easy answer from us on that one, I'm afraid.
No, well, I think certainly with the and I want to ask you about the authors that you've collected in this book, because it's a wonderful group. I would expect that bringing together this brain power, the easy answers are elusive, but at least we can get some answers. We're chatting with Julia Lane and Victoria Stodden on KZSU FM Stanford, discussing their recently published co-edited book with Stefan Bender and Helen Nissenbaum, Privacy, Big Data, and the Public Good: Frameworks for Engagement, from Cambridge University Press. That subtitle there, Julia Victoria, Frameworks for Engagement, is interesting, because you're framing the book not around presentation of data, but actual use with and engagement with, and I, of course, this is circular, I just used the word, but interaction with the data. And I think that ties, that ties to this third phrase, public good. I mean, the difference between data being found, not made, seems to me to tie into at least my conception of public good. But I'll continue in this structure, perhaps, and go back to Victoria, unless, Julia, you'd like to take this. How do you define public good for purposes of this book?
So my undergrad degree, I also have a master's degree in econ, but I think Julia maybe should take a stab at this, because public good, we actually had a discussion, we discussed all these terms carefully among the authors, and we had a discussion around this term public good. We went, among the four of us, we went back and forth on it quite a bit, and eventually it won out, and I think our emphasis was that this isn't about winning elections, this isn't about, you know, making tons of money in a tech startup from data. This is really, from the researcher's perspective, how do we draw conclusions and use this? And I think that was part of our desire to put a phrase that has its own sort of freighted meaning itself in there, that it this isn't just, isn't this exciting that we've got all this data now, what can we do with it? This is really, how do we be measured and responsible about this, and how do we make sure those channels to research, inference, and utilization of the data, particularly by researchers, still remain open?
That's a good way of putting it. I would remind you that a major impetus of this was, as I said, the Center for Urban Science and Progress at NYU. So it was very much in the context of how can you use data to improve public policy, public management of activities, and how can you get the research community to help inform public policy. So it was very much along those lines. So the notion here is, if you're thinking about Google or Facebook, they have zillions of high quality computational scientists and data scientists and who are mining the data to generate information. In a public context where you have cities trying to figure out how to use data to provide higher quality services to the taxpayer at lower expense, you don't have that host of people. You don't have that capacity within the organizations. So you really need to get the researcher access in order to inform public policy. So really what we were talking about in terms of the public good is trying to help federal, state, and local governments make better decisions to produce services for the public and to engage the researcher community in doing so.
So, Julia, let me follow up here with this question before we take a very quick break. There are three primary themes in the book. Perhaps you could give us the quick. And I know this is, I could leave and come back a half hour later. So let me ask you just to kind of introduce it, and then we'll get into a little bit more detail after the break. The three main themes of the book, perhaps reflected, as I mentioned in the introduction, by the part names, but also I think a bit more than that. So take a couple minutes here, if you would, to give us the skeletal overview of those themes.
So the three parts of the book are legal, practical, and statistical. So the legal framework we've already talked about a little bit. It struggles with what is the what are the laws that are applicable, both from a statutory, I think, tort and case, and you have some of the really great minds in this country thinking about that. That's Kathy Stromberg, Helen Nissenbaum. You've got Victoria Stodden and Paul Ohm. And we also have an economist in there, Alessandro Acquisti, who's thinking about it from a cost-benefit point of view. The second part of the book is the practical framework. You know, how is someone who's trying to make decisions for the public good, what guidance can we give them? And so it provides insights from people who've been in there in the trenches trying to figure out how to get stuff done. And so that's people like Steve Coonan and Mike Holland from the Center of Urban Science and Progress, Bob Gerger from the University of Chicago, Peter Elias from the European side, John Wilbanks, who I believe has been or is going to be on the show, and Carl Landwehr from a cybersecurity point of view. And, of course, Sandy Pentland and Daza Greenwood, who taught very practical terms. What do you do when you want to go ahead, you don't want to spend your life contemplating your navel, and you just want to get stuff done? The third one is, okay, now you've done the data, you've done the analysis. How do you distribute it in a way that protects confidentiality? And what statistical methods are available? And here we have Frauke Kreuter, who's a top-of-the-line survey methodologist. We have Alan Carr and Jerry Reiter, who have spent careers thinking about statistical disclosure limitation from a survey point of view. And then we have what I think is pathbreaking work by Cynthia Dwork at Microsoft, which really tips the statistical view on its head and starts thinking about it from a cryptographic framework.
We're chatting with Julia Lane and Victoria Stodden on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to the show regularly, you know that it's on KZSU, which is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways you can make a donation to KZSU. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu, or you can go to our webpage and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless, I hope that you continue to listen to the station. So, Victoria, let me come back to you and ask you, There's the three primary themes, of course, all tie, to this very, ultimately very practical subtitle of frameworks for engagement. And I think it'll be helpful at this point to offer some examples of how big data is integrated into our lives today, both in known and less known ways. So I think I'll ask both Victoria, you and Julia this question. I'll start with Victoria. Can you give us an example of where, and the kind of example that you were really focusing on here, of big data's integration?
Oh, sure. So I think there's sort of two sides, actually, to how you can interpret that. So one is, what are concrete examples of where this is happening, this sort of what we've, I guess, in this conversation been calling this kind of accidental data collection rather than the purposeful data collection around research. And then there's the other side, which is, so the reality may be one thing, but then there's this public perception of another thing. And so I think it is the case that we are gathering much more data on people than we ever have in the past. However, there is also this important perception out there that lots of data is being collected on us and so on, and how do we kind of address it? So I think we wanted to really tackle both of those issues, sort of talk about this as a current issue that people are concerned about and interested in, and also, really kind of, get practical about real examples. So, for example, I think the main source of all this data is how digitized our lives have become. So interactions with the computer, where Julia's example of sort of uploading your CV, maybe in a job context, and maybe you're trusting that third party or whoever is hosting for wherever you're uploading your CV to kind of keep it confidential. But have you really actually looked, and do you have a kind of guarantee that they're going to keep it confidential? Or maybe you're just uploading it and it's going public, and do you even know, or have you thought about that? And this is something, now that we're using the computer, we're using the internet all over our lives, not just for social interaction through Facebook and so on. We're doing our Google searches. We're using it for jobs and getting work done in a way that we never have in the past. I mean, we're sitting here, all three of us, on our computers connecting and doing this interview right now. And so I think there's this kind of integration just in our daily lives, like cell phone use and so on, that people have an awareness that they're sort of donating all this data. But what's really usable? What do they have realistic expectations of privacy around? And what's actually legal and what's protected when they're uploading it? Because when you put your CV out on the web, I think most people would kind of have an understanding that putting something out on the internet, you probably don't have much of a expectation of privacy around that. On the other hand, certain people would say, well, that's my CD. Of course they should be protecting this. I mean, that's obvious. I shouldn't even have to kind of talk about it. And so these sort of changing norms around information sharing, I think this is really something where there's, like I said, there's this perception that there's so much information out there and being shared. And then there's this underlying reality where we're really seeing these very clear examples where there's just this enormous amount of digitization in our lives. And as Julia mentioned, in cities now with sensors and so on, we are just seeing sort of governments even able to collect enormous amounts of data as well.
Julia, do you want to add an example?
So I kind of like the CD example, but let me give you one that may make your readers sit up and pay attention a little bit. So let me give you a classic situation. So we're very interested in the health of the population, right? And we're very interested in the impact of different types of interventions. So the old way of doing things is, you know, you do a survey on individuals and households before the intervention, you design a comparison and control group, and then you go and do the intervention and then you collect data afterwards. Very expensive, very time consuming, not particularly reliable, I have to say, the quality of the data, and it's point in time. So there are other ways of collecting data on people's health, and that's through the sewer system. Okay, so it turns out that every day, every household, there is data that is flushed down the toilet, and I don't need to get any more specific than that, but if you were to go through and take a look at those data and pull out the microbiomes, you could get data at the household level on a flow basis. And look at the impact of different types of health interventions. You know, if I drop a fresh fruit into the area, if I provide discounts to households to buy better quality nutrition, we can analyze information that is in the sewage system. No one's ever been able to collect that type of information before. Let me give you another example, which is clearly on the bad side. You'll all remember the Boston bomber, and you will remember that there was an enormous amount of excitement after the bomb went off. Many people had taken photos, they put them up on the web, lots of crowdsourcing to try and figure out who the people were who had committed this dastardly deed. There was video from the Lord and Taylor camera that was going outside. Initially, that crowdsourcing identified the wrong guy, caused quite a lot of heartache, eventually the data were used to actually identify the right person. Those are the examples for big data. They are being, in the Boston bomber case, they were not being used for research, but the data are available, they're found, they're not made, as I said before, and one of the things that we were looking for is what are the appropriate business, legal, and technical approaches for doing ethical research, and you'll find a lot of substantive suggestions in that second section.
We're chatting with Julia Lane and Victoria Studden, co-editors, along with Stefan Bender and Helen Nissenbaum, of the book Privacy, Big Data, and the Public Good, Frameworks for Engagement. It may shock both of you, speaking of big data, to note that we're approaching about 15 minutes left of the interview. Although we've covered a lot of ground, I want to ask you some follow-up questions here. And you've just alluded to one big one there, Julia, which is how these sets are collected. And I agree with you that certainly I hadn't thought of the sewer system as a source of data until you mentioned it, and I'm not sure what I'm going to do now, but as you said, it's probably best left not for radio. So let's come back to this issue of access and confidentiality, because that's I think a big question here. You know, with both you and Julia and Victoria have talked about, you know, there's data sets that come from quasi-public sources, from public sources, from private sources, and the interaction between the public and the private here, and perhaps I should be more specific and really say perhaps nonprofit and for-profit entities or government and the private sector, to me is an enormous challenge. So perhaps I'll start with you, Victoria, on this. Put aside the question of whether confidentiality is different than privacy, because I think it's an important question, but I want to ask a practical one. Is there an issue of protecting commercial information that needs to be protected, protecting privacy that needs to be protected, while assuring that the public, because we are focusing on the public good, has access to the data that it needs? So how do you deal in the context of big data with this public-private interaction and the values inherent there?
Oh, that's a great question. That's a really hard question. The way that it's being done now is to some degree on a case-by-case basis. So, for example, with Google, they've put policies in place where you can request your data, and extending to the user some feeling of control over the data. There's lots of data collection that goes on when you're online, for example, and that seems to be the exception more than the rule, the way Google has chosen to handle this. It opens all these very interesting issues around agency and around a sense of ownership over data. So these have become a lot more complicated. If you ask someone about data, say, for example, they're participating in a study, it doesn't even have to be something where it's just being collected through web surfing or whatnot, but say even if they voluntarily enroll in, say, a clinical trial or something more traditional, a participant may feel like they would like to share their data. They're actually very comfortable with this idea of having their data be made public, and they would like to help the research, particularly if, you know, maybe they have some special data to contribute on rare diseases or whatnot. And it's very difficult, actually, with a lot of the protections around data, for them to be able to kind of for people to be able to sort of make that sort of obey the wishes, in a sense, of that person who's involved in the study. But then there's also these other things. Well, so maybe that person doesn't own the data. Maybe the person doing the data collection in the study owns the data, or maybe the person hosting and managing the data in a sort of dedicated repository owns the data, or maybe the person or the entity that funded the study owns the data. And in some sense, and I've spoken with people who come from all those groups, and there is a sense that they do have ownership over this data. And this is new. It used to be the case when, Census Bureau or the government would go and do purposeful data collection, that was very clearly census data. There wasn't a lot of controversy about this, and nor was there necessarily a sense of agency over the data like what we're having now with participants in studies. And so you sort of have this push from the populace now around data, and how do I actually make sure that you're using the data for the purpose that you said you were going to use it when you collected, and so on. By the way, if you read in the book that the legally entities have to do this. And it opens up all these interesting examples around informed consent as well. So data that's collected, for example, there's been an enormous amount of press recently over a study done, I believe, within Facebook mm-hmm. on using user data and manipulating the view of Facebook that their users might see, and then trying to infer behavioral implications from this. And this was published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. And so the sort of the questions that people had about this study is, well, did people really give informed consent when they signed up for Facebook? Maybe there are sort of a few lines in the terms of use saying you can use my data for research, but so maybe there's consent, but how do we really understand that as informed? I mean, people weren't given a chance to opt out of the study. They were just sort of in this, having their Facebook feeds manipulated with the goal to manipulate their emotional states. And then there's another point when it comes to private data as well, which is how do we as a community verify these results? And scientific research and inference traditionally has turned on being able to verify these results. And this is a lot of kind of the push towards data access, is being able to say, okay, I understood how you got those results, and I can actually go ahead and verify your findings. With proprietary data, like, for example, the Facebook data in that study, I'm sure it's not public, right? This is people's, you know, interaction with Facebook and their data and so on. So how do I even know that these results are right? I mean, this is also a shift in paradigm from the type of research that we're doing. Whereas in the olden days, what we would have expected is to be able to actually do verify based on, say, access to Census Bureau data, to use our same example.
So, Julia, let me turn to you, because related to exactly what Victoria was just talking about, right, is the issue of, as again you've pointed out in the book, right, the use of this data for public good, which of course requires the capacity to use the data in the first place. And clearly to me, there is a capacity issue inside government. And I don't mean that to say that, of course, we're not talking intellectual capacity, I don't think, I'm confident to say. We're talking about literally resources. So perhaps I'll ask you this question. I mean, given the work that you've done for years, Julia, what do governments, in your view, and I know that that's too broad, so perhaps I'll say, let's start here. We're recording this show in the United States. Perhaps we can start in the U.S., but, you know, feel free to use examples of other governments. But generally speaking, do governments currently have the capacity to handle big data as you've defined it?
In general, no. And part of it is the legal framework's not clear. So part of it is, as you pointed out, capacity. But part of it is, there is some concern about the legal framework. The other part, and I think Victoria hit on it yet again, is we actually don't know very well how to make inference from these data. So what we're used to using in a survey framework is we have some concept of what a population frame is. We have some concept of what the sources of error are from the different ways of collecting the data. And what we do is we adjust as best we can so that we can make generalizable inference. And let me give you an example. When you don't do that, we learned to our cost the Literary Digest example in the 1930s, where we were just starting to learn how to use survey data. The frame was wrong. They were using telephone records and people who'd registered for cars, and so they made inference about a presidential election that were dead wrong. And so I think for governments and for statistical agencies, a big concern with big data is not just capacity and legal, but also how can you make inference that will inform policy that is correct. And that is why it's so critical to get the research community engaged and involved, because it's going to take a lot of very, very smart people to solve that problem. It's not been solved yet. The examples with Google flu trends and many other examples that come up suggest that we don't know the properties of the data at all. A lot of these correlations that show up are simply because the data themselves are non-stationary. So they both embody some exogenous factor that that is highly correlated but is not causal. So the answer to your question is we're in the very early stages. It's a bit of the Wild West out there. And we absolutely need a bunch of scientists to be working on the data, and it's critical that we do so. I do want to make one comment on the Facebook example.
Please.
In my view, that research was not big data. It was actually going out and purposefully collecting data. So it was not much different from a survey. It was just that the medium was different. to me, big data means data that already exists, that are found, that are sitting out there. And now the question is, under what circumstances and business, legal, and technical approaches can we use to do the analysis?
You know, as you mentioned that, Julie, and I'm sorry to say, we are well into the unfair portion of the show, which is I define as where I ask questions that you don't have time to answer adequately, and then I ask the questions anyway. Hence the unfair part. The idea that there is all of this information out there that we as humans have been unable to fathom and therefore use for our purposes, has certainly been brought into stark relief with the aggregation of data, right? And so, as you were answering this question, I was thinking about recent stories over the last several months involving retailers who and Target in the United States that were able to identify when or the fact that some of their customers were pregnant before their customers knew, based upon what they were purchasing and so forth.
I think it was the customer's father in this case. I think that you've actually made a very, very good point here. One of the reasons why the research on big data is so exciting is what it enables you to do is zero in on outliers, on the small proportion of the population that generate a lot of the activity, either in healthcare or expenditures or whatever. We tend to have a power law, so there are very few people that drive a lot of the activity. So big data enable us to look at that. But what that then means is the traditional statistical disclosure limitation approaches to protect confidentiality, which is anonymization, won't hold. Mm-hmm. So the twin pillars under which we've historically done research, which is one, informed consent doesn't exist. It's either comprehensive or comprehensible, as Helen says, but not both. And then the other one, which is anonymization, and that there's these magic 17 personally identifiable indicators, neither of those hold. There is no anonymity. There is no informed consent.
That scary note means now I'm going to ask you a very practical question. I think both Victoria and Julie, you've alluded to the answers here already, but I'm going to ask explicitly anyway. So, the practical side of all of this is, as Julie just indicated, is that we're still in the early stages, even though the phrase big data has been around for a few years. That, of course, in the scheme of things, is very, very early. If you had the ability to make an immediate change or improvement in how we deal with big data, and I'm making it that amorphous, but you had to pick one. What is the first order priority? Is it changing the law? Is it adding capacity? Is it scientists engaging in a different way? So, Victoria, I'll come to you, and again, unfair portion of the show, I'm asking you to answer this question in about a minute. But that one first thing we need to do is, Victoria, what?
You didn't say anything about money, so I'm just going to assume we've got infinite resources.
Yes. This is the magic wand, yes.
One of the things that I would like to snap my fingers and have happen are centralized repositories for this data, and also for the software that people have been using to clean, filter, and analyze the data. Right now, things are very disparate, so you sort of have, like Julia's early example, you have like people's CVs just sort of floating out there on the web, and then you have also sort of some very sophisticated repositories controlling data access and so on. I would like to see us really bolster our housing, our repositories of this data, and that's how we can start to think about access controls, privacy, and so on, and as Julia mentioned, the data generation mechanisms, and also, as you mentioned, Dave, the aggregation issues and how we start linking these data sets together and uncovering what we thought were anonymous data sets, and we can sort of pull information out. So I think having some very coherent approach to how we house, store, and access the data, it would, if I could snap my fingers and do that tomorrow, I think that's what I would do.
Julia, last word, your magic wand first act would be?
Well, I'm going to rule out the possibility of legal changes given the current congressional
environment. Even magic won't solve that.
And magic ain't going to do it. Okay. So, I completely agree with what Victoria said. The you know, Sandy Pentland has a great line, which is big data are the oil of the internet. They're the oil of the new economy. We need to be building interstate highways to be able to handle this. We've had artisan approaches where different groups have tried to solve the problem separately, and that's simply not going to cut it anymore. We need a concerted national effort, and indeed international, to build business, legal, and technical approaches that provide clear guidelines to the research community and to the to the government community, to public sector, as to how to handle these data.
Julia Lane of the American Institutes for Research, Professor Victoria Studden of the Institute for Data Sciences and Engineering at Columbia University, co-editors with Stefan Bender and Helen Nissenbaum of the really terrific compendium of brains and writing around the issues of privacy, big data, and the public good, frameworks for engagement, from Cambridge University Press. Thank you for joining me so much on the show today. As we've indicated, 1 hour or a little bit less is not nearly enough to get into these issues. So you continue to be invited back as these issues take shape. But in the interim, thank you for joining us today, for educating my listeners. I appreciate you taking the time.
Thoroughly enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, David. It's always such a pleasure.
My pleasure. So we have a number of great guests coming up on the show. Coming up next week, David Zweig, author of Invisibles, The Power of Anonymous Work in an Age of Relentless Self-Promotion. After that, Professors James Grimmelman of the University of Maryland School of Law and David Post of Temple University School of Law and the recent U.S. Supreme Court decision in ABC v. Aereo, as well as the Facebook study that we've discussed a little bit today on the show. Professor Frederick Schauer, the David and Mary Harrison Distinguished Professor of Law at the University of Virginia and formerly of Harvard's Kennedy School, on the amorphous, speaking of phrases that are unclear, right to know. Nabiha Syed of Levine, Sullivan, Koch, and Schultz on drone technology and freedom of information. Professor Dave Columbia of Virginia's Commonwealth University, author of The Cultural Logic of Computation. And then rounding out this quarter on hearsay culture, member of European Parliament Marietje Schaake on democracy and technology in Europe. I am in the process, that is our summer schedule, and I'm very excited about it. I'm in the process of scheduling guests for the fall on hearsay culture. As I had mentioned on a previous show, unintentionally, I am trying to corner the market on all scholars involving technology law from the University of Maryland, which is why I'm having on separately Professors Daniel Citron and Professor Frank Pasquale, both of whom are also repeat guests on hearsay culture, discussing their forthcoming works on hate crimes and corporate secrecy, respectively, as well as Professor Mark Fenster of the Levin College of Law at the University of Florida on government transparency. As always, you have a number of ways to listen to Hearsay Culture. You can listen 2 p.m. Pacific time on Wednesdays on KZSU by streaming the show at kzsulive.stanford.edu. You can then get the show via podcast by going to hearsayculture.com, by going to the iTunes page for the Center for Internet Society, and also by going to the webpage for the Center for Internet Society at Stanford at cyberlaw.stanford.edu. There are also a couple of radio stations who are airing the show periodically, including Freirag Radio in Innsbruck, Austria, who are airing the show about once a month. So if you happen to be in that beautiful part of the world, you can listen to the show there. You can also listen to the show via one or two other stations who are airing the show on a less frequent basis, but you can find all this information by going to hearsayculture.com. As always, I welcome your comments, suggestions, and feedback at dave@hearsayculture.com. So thank you for joining me today on the show. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.